Raise your hand if you ever saw The Curious Life of Benjamin Button. Good. So I'm not going to ruin it, mostly. What's curious about The Curious Life of Benjamin Button is that his life goes in reverse. He begins his life as an aged man, and the older he gets, the younger he becomes. On his way toward infancy, starting in his elderly place. And as that story unfolds, as he reaches middle age, even though he's getting younger by the day, he meets a woman, they fall in love, they bring forth a child. But as they come to realize the implications of having brought a child into the world, with she aging towards old age like we are accustomed to, and he towards infancy and yet ending his life as an infant, they become convinced that it probably would be best for him not to be in this child's life, given his fate. And here at the end of the film, that child, who is now an adult woman, is sitting in the hospital room of her aging mother, aging and dying mother, and for the first time, reading notes from her father, whom she never knew, but who had always wished that he could have been the father for her, that he wasn't. And so in this moment, you're going to hear her recount that, and then I'll tell you why we're showing this when we're concluded.
It's for me. 1970. I was two. Happy birthday. I wish I could have kissed you goodnight. They're all for me. Five. I wish I could have taken you to your first day of school. Six. I wish I could have been there to teach you to play piano. 1981. 13. I wish I could have told you not to chase some boy. I wish I could have held you when you had a broken heart. I wish I could have been your father. Nothing I ever did will replace that. I guess you went to India. For what it's worth, it's never too late, or in my case,
too early, to be whoever you want to be. There's no time limit. Start whenever you want. You can change or stay the same. There are no rules to this thing. We can make the best or the worst of it. I hope you make the best of it. I hope you see things that startle you. I hope you feel things you never felt before. I hope you meet people with a different point of view. I hope you live a life you're proud of. And if you find that you're not, I hope you have the strength to start
all over again.
Kids. What you mostly hear from your parents is stuff that they want you to do. Would you do that? Would you, this, not that, this, but not, right? And maybe you slip into thinking that mostly what your parents want is what they want from you, what they want out of you. But what you hear in a 2-minute clip like that is actually what parents want, and what teachers want, and what coaches want, anybody that's a mentor or a whatever. It's what they want for you that really animates them. And what you hear Benjamin Button speaking now to his adult daughter across decades in which he was not present is all the things that he wanted for her. Because that's full of love. And that's full of longing and wistfulness for what was not, but what he hoped would be for her. You can tell a lot about a person from what they want from you, but you can tell even more about a person and what they want for you. And we are in the middle of a little vestibule of a series on praying, about practicing the presence of the Lord, about rehearsing each time we become quiet before Him and still ourselves and gather thoughts and express them in our voice, that we are rehearsing, so to speak, what does it mean to live before the Lord? That's what practicing the presence is. He who is invisible, we believe again that He is real through our praying. And as we've said this week and next week and then last week, we're listening actually to what Jesus is praying for you. Because as it says in Hebrews chapter 7, He lives to intercede for them. And so in John 17, we're focusing in particular, just as Benjamin Button longed for his daughter, what does Jesus want for you? That you would know His heart. And that might be one more inducement to praying as He prays. We're in the middle of that section, and we're going to consider what He wants for you under three headings. He wants you, so to speak, to be prepared. Prepared for a kind of presence. But prepared for a kind of presence in a very particular kind of power. Prepared for presence in power. We're going to focus on the last three verses of the passage, but we're going to kind of get a running start to earlier in John chapter 17. So if you will, I wonder if you might stand. John chapter 17, we'll start where we began last week and then skip then a little bit later. Starting in verse 6. I have manifested Your name to the people whom You gave Me out of the world. Yours they were, and You gave them to Me, and they have kept Your word. Now they know that everything that You have given Me is from You. For I have given them the words that You gave Me, and they have received them and have come to know in truth that I came from You, and they have believed that You sent Me. I am praying for them. I am praying not for the world, but for those whom You have given Me, for they are Yours. And then skipping down to verse 14. I've given them Your word, and the world has hated them, because they're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that You take them out of the world, but that You keep them from the evil one. They're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As You sent Me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sake, I consecrate Myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may have a seat. What does He want for us? What does Jesus want for us? I know that when you hear the word Jesus, I mean, there may be an instinct in you based upon whatever assumptions you make or based upon your background, you're always like, Jesus, yeah, what does He want for me today? But really, I want us all to, and He does. He does want things from you. But what He wants from you has everything to do with what He wants for you. These are distinct, but they're inseparable and never tear asunder what the Lord has brought together. What does He want for you? He wants you to be prepared. Prepared, where am I getting that? Listen to verse 17 again. Sanctify them. That's one of those big holy, radioactively holy words. Yeah, we're all supposed to, you know, with an aura around us, and we're like to glide with robes on. Sanctify them. What is that? If you know that word, you know that it typically refers to the idea of becoming pure, of being holy. And so if you're around the church for long enough, you've probably heard this big word from which this word comes, sanctification, right? It's having both inwardly and outwardly the heart of Jesus resident and manifest in you. That's what it means to be sanctified. To say that Jesus is Lord is more than ascribing to him authority, though that is also true. It is saying to us that Jesus is the index of what it means to be human. He is the prototype. He is the measure. He is the model. What does it mean to be a person? Study the life of Jesus. He is many things. He says many things. He does many things. But everything that he does is meant to give you insight in what it means to be human. And to be sanctified is to become not only like him, but finally more human. Despite all the ways in which our humanity and our experience and the world we are finding in distorts that. He's a model, and that's his life. But there's a particular sliver of what it means to be sanctified that I'm trying to shave off here and to give our focus to. Because to be holy, to be pure, to be sanctified is also to mean to be set apart. To be marked as distinct from others. Not that you might look down on them. Not that you might hold them in judgment or disparagement or disdain. But nevertheless, to think of yourself differently because of what he is doing and what Jesus is praying for you and what he wants for you. Let me kind of put it in a more familiar frame. If you're a surgeon, you don't go ever into a surgical theater until you first scrub in. And there's some wonderful YouTube videos out there about surgeons scrubbing in. I watch some of them. It's fabulous. I never knew. Why do they hold their hands up like that, right? They go in there. They get out those, you know, shrink-wrapped sponges. They pull out this great soap. And they every fingernail. Like, my kids could learn from this. You know, everything. We're going to wash everything really well. And it takes minutes at a time. And they go all the way down their elbow. And they do everything. It takes a long time. And then what do? They rinse. And they do this. And they keep their hands up all the time. And I'm like, why do they keep their hands up? Because when you rinse, right, the dirty water goes down in your hands. You don't want that. You keep the hands up in the air like that. You want the dirty water to go down, not on your fingertips. And then you glove up. That's being a surgical. Then you are surgically sterile right there, right? Why? So that they can look down on others because they're not surgically sterile? No. It's so that they can walk into that surgical theater and actually be able and capable of doing what they've been tasked to do. They're fit. They're prepared. Take another analogy. If you've ever been in military service, you never went on deployment until you first went to boot camp. You went through basic. And if you went through basic and you went through boot camp, were you prepared for everything that you might encounter in a theater or on a tour? Of course not. But if you didn't go through boot camp, if you didn't do basic, you get out in the field, you're a danger. You're a danger to yourself. You're a danger to everybody around you. You study all manner of things in order to be what? Prepared. You are prepped for service in whether you're scrubbing in or whether you're going through basic. That's the nature of what it means to be here. Prepared, though, for what? Be patient. We'll get there in a minute. What Jesus means for us to be sanctified is that we would be set apart for something. But before we talk about what we're set apart for, let's first talk about what we're set apart with. What are doctors set apart with? They study anatomy, they study physiology, they study pathology, they study chemistry, they study pharmacology, all of that stuff. That prepares them. What do soldiers study? Discipline, teamwork, terrain, tactics, ballistics, munitions, all of that. They learn all of that in order to be what? Prepared for whatever they've been tasked with. What does it mean to be sanctified in Jesus' sense of the word and what he's praying for you? Sanctify them with what? Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. There is something that you and I are to be prepared with in order to be prepared for something that he intends for us. We are meant to be set apart with truth. What truth? Truth in particular. Remember what we recall from last week? That if you're a follower of Jesus, you are first of all to think of your identity as one who was a gift from the Father to the Son. You're a gift. Not just something, not just something I picked up off the side of the road. You're a gift from the Father to the Son. And the words that the Father gifts to the Son gifts to anyone who would follow him. What words? The truth about Jesus. Which truth? You know, his height, build, pedigree, complexion, birth, origin, all of that? No, not really. That's not central. Remember from verse 8. I've given them the word that you gave me. They have received them and have come to know in truth what? That I came from you and they have believed what? That you have sent me. There is particular truth that we're sanctified in order to be prepared for whatever that might be. Sanctified with the knowledge that Jesus is more than a teacher. He is more than one that manifested a bunch of practices that we might also replicate. We are meant to believe that Jesus is both from God and sent by God. And we're meant to be sanctified in that truth. Not simply knowing facts in order to impress people with our knowledge. That's not what it means to be prepared with the truth. If I could borrow a metaphor, to be sanctified in the truth is to come to believe something such that you inhabit it. This truth becomes for you like a home is. It's a refuge. It is both your foundation and your roof. It is for you a consolation. It is also a confrontation. It is a place that you consider to be a haven. It guides you. It strengthens you. It replenishes you. It protects you. And sometimes it stares you in the face and says, "Do you see what I see?" The word of where he came from and why he was sent to you is meant to be something that we inhabit. Why? Because in this life, you're going to be tempted, among other things. You're going to be tempted to hate yourself for everything that you regret, everything that was done and left undone. Wouldn't it be great to know that there is a grace and a love that is steadfast and deeper than all your sin? Yes, it is good. And for that to feel like it's real requires that you learn to inhabit it, that you be sanctified in that truth. You are going to be tempted from time to time to want to take vengeance on people that have wronged you. And the impulse will make perfect sense. You'll be wronged, you'll be slighted, you'll be harmed, you'll be treated in your mind unjustly, and you will want to fix it now by whatever means necessary. And there will be something to remind you that you too have been forgiven. And it doesn't mean that you won't want things to change. It doesn't mean that justice ought not to be done. It just means that you leave some things to the Lord and even encountenance the possibility of forgiving them. That they would come to you in repentance and make amends for what they did. You will be tempted not to do as he has done, but as he sanctifies you in that truth, it will become something that you will have to consider. And you will be tempted to lose hope. The legs will be taken out from underneath you. The trajectory you're on will be broadly and deeply, abruptly changed. And hope will evaporate like the dew on the morning. And you will want somehow to believe that there is a love that is even greater than everything that you have lost. And that that which you have in him is even greater than everything that you might have to part company with now in this life. And you will have to part company with everything now in this life. See, when you're on an airplane and turbulence happens, if you're like me, you grip. And you trust that the pilot is untroubled by what's going on up front. And if you're in a stairwell and you start to feel dizzy, you will reach for the closest thing to stabilize you. That's what it means to be prepared and sanctified in the truth. Not just a bunch of facts that you can rattle off and go, "Look what I know." But a kind of instinct that you reach for certain truths and ideas that hold you, that help you, that stabilize you, that will confront you when you need to be confronted and will console you when you need to be consoled. That's what he wants for you, to be sanctified in that truth. Bible study kind of takes on a different character here, doesn't it? I'm so impressed that you know about Isaiah. Tell me about your suffering. What happens then? What he wants for you as a father to a son, as a mother to a son, as a teacher to a student, as a coach to an athlete. I want you to believe something so deeply that it is for you almost like a refuge. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. That's what you're sanctified with, but for what? It's not simply that you would be stronger and solid in yourself, though that's a good thing. It's just not the whole and sub and substance of why he wants that and prays that for you. It's the second thing here that's really just part two of the first thing. He wants you to be prepared. Prepared for what? Prepared, which what I'm calling here is presence. To be faithfully present, to borrow a phrase. Where am I getting at? Listen again to verse 18. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. Sent. He's talking to his disciples, but he's actually praying, as he will more so next week, about anybody that ever follows him. I'm sending you out. From Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. That's the plan. You're not going to stay put. I don't want you camped out here at the coffee shop forever. I'd like you to move out. I'd like you to relocate. I'd like you to find yourself in a new climate in a way in which, what? Back up to that slide there, Russ. You're sent that you might be present to that world wherever you find yourself. Now, that tradition of being sent out from where you are to some other unfamiliar place, that tradition continues. It happens every day in every place where there is a church. We long to send people out, to go where you are, to where that you are not. But what is true of those who are relocating is also true of everybody that's just sort of occupied in place. You are sent. You are supposed to think of yourself as being sent in this sense. You're sent. You're supposed to think of yourself as one who's to be present. Present to where you find yourself. It's not an obscure idea. People have been sent for as long as there have been disciples of Jesus. But to be sent is to be present. Prayer, if we might back up a little bit, the whole series, we're calling it Practicing the Presence. He who is real yet invisible, through our learning to pray, we come to realize that he is there and as is as close as your next breath. We use our words. And when Jesus says to his disciples, I'm sending you, he is sending you with a message. We are sent with words. The one phrase that St. Francis of Assisi never said, it's the last time they ever called him Assisi. You've probably heard this. Preach the gospel, use words if necessary. He never said that. Words matter. Words have potency. Words have meaning. Words where we can offer them, if anybody is willing to listen, those are good things. We don't shy away from words if the opportunity presents itself. But obviously Jesus is speaking of, I'm sending you with words. I'm sending you with a message. I'm sending you with an idea that grace is real, that God is love, and his forgiveness is everlasting. But from that derives certain ideas and certain practices that we'll call actions. Word and deed. You and I are sent with words, but also present in those words through our actions. F.D. Bruner is a commentator you hear me quote pretty often, and he goes so bold as to say this, Christians ought to have a modest but real messianic complex about themselves. Do we honor him if we think we are not messianic or we're not so sent? Right, what does Peter say in 1 Peter 3? He says, always have a defense of the faith ready and willing to offer to anybody who might ask you. And do so with gentleness and respect. Why? Because it's how we honor Christ. We honor him by bearing witness to him when anybody might be curious about what holds you together. To be present is to be present with word, but also in deed. There's a sociologist up at UVA. You've heard me talk about him before, and maybe even recently. His name is James Davison Hunter. He wrote a book called To Change the World about 15 years ago. And he says as soon as the church stops trying to change the world, they actually might. His argument is, rather than just trying to become like everybody or trying to avoid the world or build your little enclave with your own bowling alley and say, we're in this good. We're going to, y'all have a good time. Y'all go to hell in a handbasket. We're going to be good over here. He says, our objective as Christians is to be present within whatever community we find ourselves. What does Jeremiah say to Israel now that they're exiled to Babylon? Pray and go to the people that I have sent you to, for in their welfare, you will find your own. And so James Davison Hunter says, to be a Christian is to be obliged to engage the world, pursuing God's restorative purposes over all of life. Love does, to borrow his book, I forget the guy's name. Love acts. Love is a verb. I come with words of love. That love is a catalyst for action. And that action is manifested nicely and summarized nicely in the idea of being present. Now, in that book a long time ago, he kind of got up in our business when we started talking about politics. Oh my gosh, he's talking about politics and religion in the same sermon. Look out. Listen to what he says about politics. It's, after all, much easier to vote for a politician who champions child welfare than to adopt a baby born in poverty, to vote for a referendum that would expand health care benefits for seniors than to care for an elderly and infirm parent, and to rally for racial harmony than to get to know someone of a different race than yours. True responsibility invariably costs. Political participation then can and often does amount to an avoidance of responsibility. Oh, now he's gone to meddling. But there, through several examples, and I'm sure he could outline and enumerate countless more, you are beginning to understand, what does it mean to be present? If you've been sent to where you are, you're not there just for your own sake. If love is inherently looking outward, then it is worth praying and noticing, what am I doing here? Why have I been sent here? For whose sake? How can I manifest the life of Jesus wherever I find myself? I don't have to send you to Aruba. Might be nice. I don't have to send you to Aruba in order to be faithful to whatever the gospel might have for you and where you are in Arden. We're here to be present. Now, that's social causes, ethical causes, political causes. Presence plays in 10,000 places. I had the privilege for the last few days to spend time with a bunch of songwriters. I am not one. I write sermons, and I told them that so that their expectations would be set appropriately. But I get to listen to a bunch of people who have marshaled the skill of attention, of noticing the things that you and I don't notice because we're so important and so busy, of noticing things from their own stories, both of joys and of sorrows, that as our intrepid, brilliant leader guided us in thinking about how to write a song, if you can go... She borrows the idea of the hero's journey. Some of you have heard that. That many mythologies speak of a hero that is disrupted through something, and they go on a journey, and they go to dark places, and they reach a dark night of the soul, and there they find something profound, and then they kind of come up from that area, and that which they have gained along the way, they share with those that they departed from for a while. If you go deep enough, she would argue, into your sorrows or into your triumphs, not only do you discover something that is deeply personal to you, but that actually might be deeply universal to the whole world. And that's a song. You begin to surface something that was so deep that you bring it up and it becomes glory for someone else. You just thought it was for you. Oh no. That's being present. That's being attentive to what you are afraid to see or what you are too busy to see, and then offering it up almost as a gift and a sacrifice to everybody else that they might see, I have missed this. I needed to know this. I thought I was the only one. Art, including songwriting, is just one manifestation of what it means to be present. Prayer is being present. present to the Lord, noticing gifts like William Wilberforce does, berries, grass, dew, spider webs. It's being present. To you artists in the room, guess what? James Davison Hunter even has a word for you. Who knew? To artists, he says this. The obligation among artists who are Christians is, among other things, to demonstrate in ways that are imaginative and compelling that materiality is not enough for a proper understanding of human experience. That there is a durability and a permanence as well as eternal qualities that exist beyond what we see on the surface of life. In this, they must show a depth and complexity to people and the world that defy the one or two-dimensional existence of modern life. In the process, it's possible to symbolically portray possibilities of beauty and fullness we have not yet imagined. And you thought it was just sort of expressing your skill. Stop it. It's bigger than that. It's more necessary for us that you bring to light what you have been startled by and arrested by, and now are capable of representing unto us through your own unfiltered experience, that we might see the beauty and go, God is good. You've been sent, to borrow a phrase, to share the presence of Jesus, and that plays in 10,000 places. And that's what he wants for you, whether you're an artist or you couldn't sing two notes, to manifest his life in the world wherever you find yourself. And all of that sounds so good, and all of it perhaps sounds awfully intimidating. Jesus is our model for that. Whatever I have heard, he says, I give to you. Whatever I see the Father doing, he says, I do for you. Whatever he's told me, that which I do. He is the model of being present to his Father and being prepared, fit for service, that he might then be a presence in the world. He's not out of it. He's just not of it. He's for it, but he's not seduced by it. That's what he means, I'm not of the world. He's just like you and me. He's just not tricked. He sees through it. He sees the glory of it, but he also sees our distortions of it. How in the world will we ever be prepared for the kind of presence he's speaking of? I want to play for you a moment that will always stay with me from Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War. It's a letter. You might have heard it before, and even if you have, hear it again.
A week before the Battle of Bull Run, Sullivan Ballou, a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers, wrote home to his wife in Smithfield.
July the 14th, 1861, Washington, D.C. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I am no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I have enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I've enjoyed them for so long. And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years. when God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple. It shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again.
Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run.
Was deeply personal for him in writing to his wife and his longing for her, does it not surface something deeply universal in all of us to believe that there is a love that outlasts our death? You bet it does. He writes a letter that is a gift to us that's been preserved for history, and expressing longing for his wife and longing for his boys and longing for an end to this civil war. That is his letter. Jesus has written us a letter, and it is meant to be more than simply poignant. It is meant to be power. When he says in the last verse of our passage, I consecrate myself for their sake, that they also may be sanctified in truth. In the original language, the word there for consecrate and sanctify, it's the same word. But the translators, I think, wisely create a certain distinction between the two translations of it. Why? To be sanctified, prepared for presence, is all our task if we are his. We are meant to be present at cost, in love. But when he says, I consecrate myself, it is not simply I am setting myself apart to love. I'm setting myself apart like a lamb to be slaughtered, to be dedicated for your good. And the cross is his letter to us. Not simply a letter of poignancy, but a letter of power by his Spirit. He is the strength that is meant to undergird anything that we might give ourselves to. It is that story, it is that truth, it is his love that we are to be prepared with in order to be present. And apart from that story, it's just an example you will never, ever reach. His grace is sufficient for you. There's a woman who wrote an essay that's in the sermon resource talk this week. She lost a husband in the Civil War of Rwanda in 1994. And she would go from time to time in the decades after that genocide and gather others that had survived the genocide and would ask them questions like, have any of you ever considered forgiving? And in a room full of 500 people, the author in the essay remembers one woman that raised her hand. She says, I have, and her name is Concealed. See, Concealed, in 1994, her husband and five of her seven children were murdered by a neighbor. And he was apprehended, and he was incarcerated, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison, and he served 17. But when the essayist asked this woman, Concealed, have you ever thought about forgiving? She said this: "My heart has been freed from hate by then, because we widows had been reading the gospel together, and its message prepared my heart to forgive. 17 years after the genocide, this man came to that town, and the town caught wind of it, and they formed a protest and kept him out. But the next morning, he slunk into town and went to her house and knocked on her door and confided in her that he had been haunted by the faces of those who were children for as long as his sentence had long, and he had come to ask forgiveness from the government, from the village, from her, and from the Lord. And his name is Emmanuel." What an irony. What is true of them now? He says this: "Concealed has become like a mother to me. When I need advice, I go to her. Before I got married, I talked over the details with her. She is the local official who authorized my marriage." And then of him, she says, "Emmanuel is the one I ask for help when my house needs repair. He comes anytime I ask to replace a window or mend the roof. If my cow has problems, I call him, and he knows he's always welcome to share a meal at my home. He is my son." She is mediating the presence of Jesus to a man whose name is Emmanuel, God with us, but who took almost everything that was dear to her, and she is manifesting the presence of Jesus to him. How in the world? If you were in a similar circumstance, maybe at best you would choose not to take vengeance, that you might not become what he had become. But the idea of forgiving and welcoming and calling him your son, that is not of this earth. And I don't know what else to summarize that impulse by, but that by a power outside of her. What did she say? "I was prepared by the gospel to be freed of my hate." Where does this passage push us? Students in the room, how shall I break this to you? Next month is finals month. And it's probably a given that you'll be asking your teachers in the next couple weeks, "Is that going to be on the exam? Is this going to be on the test?" If you want to think about life like an exam, think about it in these narrow terms. There's two things on the exam: the opportunity to be present and the experience of suffering. That is always on the exam of life. For that we are always accountable. And though we may all experience it differently and unevenly, it will be part of everyone's story. The opportunity to love and the experience of suffering. I think the story and the passage is pushing us to consider that if that's on the exam, if for that we are accountable, so to speak, then we must run to him and take every means of grace he offers us that we might be formed by it so that it becomes a habitation for us. That we might then learn to be present as he has been present to the world and to think of our suffering as he has thought of it, with an end, swallowed up. There will be a day when there shall no more tears and no more crying. And the only way that we might know that and believe that and rest in that is by a power that is not of the earth. That's why we come to the table. That's why we read. That's why we struggle to learn to pray. He has passed your exam, and he has made you his own. And now he has invited you into that life that you might be prepared for presence in his power. Let's pray. Would you help us to think of ourselves as you think of us? You think of us as a gift. We often think of ourselves as refuse, you think of this world as a glory, we often think of it as an inconvenience or something to complain about. You think of the opportunities to be present as a great opportunity, and we often think of it as a trifling. You think of what your son has done for us as a glory. We perhaps think of it as something that we have to aspire to and earn, and none of it is true. None of the way we think of it. Help us, sir, to believe ourselves as you do, and to see your son as a letter unto us that is more than poignant, but full of power. In his name we pray. Amen.